Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. This year alone, state lawmakers have introduced more than 250 bills restricting abortion access. On today's show, we will discuss media coverage of anti-abortion legislation across the country. We will talk about the Trump administration's attack on the Title X family planning program. And we will talk about the global gag rule, which affects women and girls around the globe. Joining us to talk about coverage is Jody Jacobson, president and editor-in-chief of Rewired.News, an online publication focused on health, rights, and justice. In February, Jody wrote a piece called Reporters Must Do Better on Abortion. She writes, media coverage of abortion care in the United States is, to be blunt, abysmal. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, Jody. We're also joined by Tara Todros-Whitehill, a photojournalist, multimedia producer, and co-founder of Vignette Interactive, an innovative storytelling company. Tara traveled to South Africa and Mozambique to see firsthand how the Trump administration's global gag rule is affecting women. Her photos are beautiful and haunting, and you can see them at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Tara. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm glad to be joining you guys.
Well, we're glad to have you. Before we dive in and talk about coverage of these issues, we, especially these days, we like to start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Tara, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I saw a lot of pictures from the New York Times about the ICE women who are trying to leave ISIS and Ivor Prickett, who did them in Jordan. It was a really lovely and haunting photo essay about that. I'm very focused on women's issues, so I'm always looking at those kind of things and how they're covered. And it was very powerful and incredibly impactful. So I really like that photo essay.
And I'm going to ask you more about what it's like to be a photographer in this time. But what really strikes you these days about photo essays, Tara, and what they can tell us about what's going on with so much happening around the globe?
I think that photos, like as opposed to other mediums, make you stop and think a lot. So when you see a full story that really gives you time and pause, I mean, every medium has its pros and cons. Like video is very impactful and you get people's voices that, you know, you can hear them. But with photos, it stops time, in my opinion. So you're really looking at that photo and reading what that means, and you get to absorb it in a different way. So, you know, powerful narratives through photo essays, I think, are one of those things that people still really respond to. And when you talk to people and they're like, oh, yeah, that photo, that really, you know, that's the thing that stood out. It's usually one photo and then they remember that. And I think that that's an important thing because it stays with people.
And what really stood out for you in particular about this story? Because there's been a lot of reporting recently about, for example, the New York Times, in a crowded Syria tent camp, the women and children of ISIS wait in limbo.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly the one I was referring to, because like it, I think that although it's it has been covered, when it's covered with really impactful photos like the ones that Ivor did, I think that we really get a sense of like the women that are suffering from it, and that's something that I think is really important. And you know, I think it gets lost a lot that way, that like, you know, the women are the ones that, especially with so much stuff happening in the world and there's so many crazy events, I feel like a lot of times women's issues and the things that women end up dealing with weigh heavy on the world, but we don't really pay attention to it. So I think it's a continual thing that needs more and more coverage. you know, everything from like the wars to things like the global gag rule, that kind of, all these things, they need more coverage, not less, because of all the other, you know, events that continue to crop up around us.
Yeah, so true. Thank you for that. We will put a link to that story at yourcallradio.org. What about you, Jody? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I read a piece in Current Affairs by Nathan Robinson on Pete Buttigieg, and I thought it was really interesting because it went deep into Buttigieg's own articulation of his biography and how he presented himself in various ways through his own book and biography. And it really brought home to me the ways in which we really know very little about this guy, that he's very much a technocrat, and that he has evaded really answering any concrete questions about policy or how he might do things. And I think it's so interesting that, you know, we all know that there's been very little attention to Elizabeth Warren, for example, versus Beto O'Rourke or Pete Buttigieg. And yet Warren and other candidates have put out very strong policy proposals and have really laid out what their visions are. And someone like Buttigieg, who, when you really dive deep into his background, doesn't have much to say for himself, really comes out as worrisome. So I thought that piece in Current Affairs was very good because it really dove deeply into who he is.
And this is the fairly young mayor from South Bend, Indiana.
Yes.
There's articles like, is he going to be the first gay president? And I've heard about this piece, so I'm glad you brought it up, Jody, because I don't know much about this guy. I just know that he's getting a ton of attention, and I was curious about this story. So this is all about Pete. Only accept politicians who have proved they actually care about people other than themselves, by Nathan Robinson in Current Affairs. Thank you, and we will link to that story also at yourcallradio.org. Jody Jacobson is president and editor-in-chief of Rewire.news. This is an excellent website focused on health, rights, and justice. And Tara Todros-Whitehill is a photojournalist and co-founder of Vignette Interactive. And I hope you can take some time to look at her haunting and beautiful photos at yourcallradio.org. She traveled to South Africa and Mozambique to see firsthand how the Trump administration's global gag rule is affecting women. So as I mentioned in the intro, it's so hard to believe that this year alone, state lawmakers have already introduced 250 bills to restrict abortion access. This is according to the Guttmacher Institute. The Trump administration is attacking family planning programs, so we'll talk about that in a minute. But I really want to start first on the global gag rule. And Jody, can you remind us what this is? The first installment of this, which happened right after Trump took office, he expanded the policy. So can you first tell us what this is and what the expansion means?
Well, are we talking about the global gag
rule
or the domestic gag?
The global gag rule.
Yeah. So I fortunately or unfortunately, as an intern, was present at the very first conference in Mexico City where this policy was first put in place by the Reagan administration, and it's kind of been a ping pong ball ever since. And basically, it denies U.S. funding to programs overseas that provide access to information, referrals, or services for abortion. And so, therefore, denies particularly women, but all people who face unwanted or dangerous pregnancies, any access to any kind of information in already resource-poor environments. Now, the policy has been sort of punted through administrations. It's usually a first-day act by any president, either to install or uninstall the global gag rule. So, you know, Clinton signed an executive order overturning the global gag rule. Bush put it back in place. And then Obama did the same thing by overturning it. And now, of course, the Trump administration has taken it further to try to expand restrictions on groups, no matter where their funding comes from. And this basically says that if an organization is getting money from the Danish government or elsewhere, or is linked to an organization that's getting money from another provider of funding, they can't do any abortion care and get access to U.S. funding. So it's really part of a global public health crisis that is being created by the far right wing across the world. It's part of the diminution of medical evidence and public health evidence, and we see it in various ways through the global gag rule, through the denial of funds for reproductive health care and contraception, through the, you know, the sort of dissemination of anti-vaccination information. I really feel like this is part of a growing and impending public health crisis that the far right wing is pushing in many, many ways, that is upending any possibility of improving, or really not even just upending the possibility, but undoing decades of work on public, on global public health. Mm. And so I see it as part of a much larger trend that, of course, affects one set of services, but is part of a much broader trend.
And Tara, you have reported on the impacts of the global gag rule. You traveled to mm-hmm. South Africa. You also traveled to Mozambique. So let's talk about what you found in Mozambique first. In the piece that you wrote for Witness World Press Photo, you can find mm-hmm. that also online. You write, when Donald Trump reinstated the Mexico City policy at the beginning of his term in 2017, many Mozambican NGOs understood that they might be affected, but they didn't understand to what extent. So what did you find there? How have these groups been affected, and how have women and girls been affected as a result?
Let me just go back a little bit first about the Trump policy, just sure. to add to what was already said. Because it affects exactly that quote, that piece that I wrote. So Trump reinstated the Mexico City policy, otherwise known as the global gag rule, but he expanded what funding was going to be affected. So in the past, only NGOs who got money for reproductive health were affected by this policy. So if you had money coming in from the U.S. for HIV/AIDS, for example, you did not have to deal with this. It was not something that was affected no matter what your so if you had an HIV policy, but you also explained to people that they had the ability to get an abortion, your funding was not affected. Trump has expanded the policy so that the entirety of the health funding from the U.S. is under scrutiny. So if you, as in Mozambique, take money for HIV/AIDS or to help with anything else, like even WASH, or nutrition, things that should never be even in the same category, if they at all deal with abortion, then they now have to deal with not, like, either stopping U.S. funding or, stopping talking about about abortion. So in Mozambique, for example, they had recently decriminalized and made legal abortion, but it hadn't actually gone into effect. So there was no abortion services in the country, but a lot of NGOs who dealt with women's health had decided that they weren't going to take, they couldn't sign in good faith this policy. So even though their funding up until that point had nothing to do with abortion services, they couldn't sign the policy, so therefore they lost their funding. And so clinics were shutting down all over Mozambique because, like, they had no longer gotten the U.S. money, even though they were getting funding from other sources. U.S. money was definitely the most. And the same for, like, sex workers. There was a clinic in Maputo that would help give screenings and contraceptives to sex workers, but it was solely mostly funded by the U.S. And because the organization that was running it decided that they couldn't sign the policy, that now that clinic has shut down. So those are the examples of things where it's like not even to do with abortion, but just because tangentially they won't sign the policy, any health funding is affected.
And as you write, when organizations are forced to pull out because they lose their funding, the people that suffer are the most vulnerable until there is another program in place.
Mm-hmm. Like when I was in Mozambique, we spent some time with women that were sex workers, and we were in this small little village, and there was this one woman who had not had HIV AIDS, and she had refused to take her medication. And for the last 4 days, she was so weak that she couldn't even leave her little bedroom. Mm. And there was another organization that was planning on coming in to take over help for these women, but it hadn't been started yet. And in the past, the ICRH, the International Center for Reproductive Health in Mozambique, would have paid for someone to take her to the hospital. But since they had no longer their funding and it had pulled out, there was no one to do that. And these women who had very little money couldn't figure out how to get her to the hospital. And so those are the people that kind of women that fall through the cracks when these policies change like this, because eventually there might be another group that comes in to give help. But in the meantime, women that are the most vulnerable, like this woman who couldn't leave her little room because she was so weak from the disease, she really suffered.
Tara Todros-Whitehill is a photojournalist and co-founder of Vignette Interactive, an innovative storytelling company. And you can see the photos that she took in Mozambique. We'll talk about her reporting in South Africa in just a couple minutes at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Jody Jacobson, president and editor-in-chief of Rewired.news, an online publication focused on health, rights, and justice. And if you have any questions for Tara and Jody, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. We're also going to talk about media coverage of abortion, which Jody wrote about in February. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. These issues are so incredibly important. And because there's so much going on and a lot of coverage on the Mueller report, we're just not getting that much a coverage of these very crucial issues. Jody, this administration is not letting up on this issue. I mean, as you mentioned, they just expanded the global gag rule. And last week, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, quote, "As a result of my decision today, we are making clear we will refuse to provide assistance to foreign NGOs that give financial support to other foreign groups in the," what he called, "global abortion industry. We will enforce a strict prohibition on backdoor funding schemes and end runs around our policy. American taxpayer dollars will not be used to underwrite abortions," end quote. So, Jody, who is really calling the shots on this in this administration?
Well, I would argue that it's the Mike Pence contingent, you know, including Pompeo and others in the far right. Their anti-choice groups have been both meeting with this administration. They met with them in November, and some of this new policy started to roll out. And then there are many different agencies in which prominent members of anti-choice, anti-public health, anti-evidence groups are embedded now in agencies. And so I want to sort of telescope back a little bit to Tara's points, because I feel like each time we come upon these things, we treat them as though they're new, and they're really not new. Mm-hmm. There were de facto bans like this under the Bush administration. There was also mm-hmm. something called the Prostitution Pledge, which if in mm-hmm. within the United States President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the Prostitution Pledge similarly required groups to sign a so-called pledge that effectively meant that they could deny care or had to report on whether or not they were going to provide care to sex workers, and then also made clinic and healthcare professionals and other support groups into sort of healthcare police, so that they had to, report people to the police if they were sex workers. And it's the same principle that happened under PEPFAR as well, where de facto groups were being denied access to HIV and AIDS money if they were connected to family planning and abortion care. So it wasn't written explicitly in policy like this, but the way that the funds flowed, both tremendous amounts of money through religious groups and then money not going to family planning groups to provide HIV and AIDS services, again, sort of took the pins, the structural pins out from under a public health approach to these crises. And these are all new and creative ways of doing the same thing, which is dismantling effective public health programs. Mm-hmm. So I want us to see this as part of a pattern rather than sort of basically new, because I think you have to look at over time how many lives have lives have been lost due to these policies, not just sort of what we would traditionally call anti-choice policies, but anti-healthcare policies that do not allow health providers to address circumstances in a holistic way.
Right.
And I think it's deeply immoral. But anyway, I just wanted to put that out there. As far as the media goes, I think it is abysmal. I maintain my point. We have, and I saw yesterday or the day before, just another example of media treatment of abortion issues in ways that are just completely ill-informed. Mm-hmm. It seems that people who write about abortion in the media either don't care or are just completely uninformed about, for example, what is a fertilized egg? What is an embryo? What is a fetus? And they use terms sort of interchangeably or in a blanket way that are just completely wrong and therefore help promote narratives that are both dangerous and wrong. And, you know, I think we can see this not only with abortion, but we can see it with the Mueller report, where you had, you know, Barr writing a short summary and the New York Times having a banner headline saying Mueller exonerates Trump. I mean, we have a really big problem in this country with press and having them be accurate about what they're doing.
And Tara, what are your thoughts about that? How do you go about writing your pieces, especially when they're so focused on photographs?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and actually the bigger issue is also that I find that when I'm pitching these stories, like for this grant, I had to, you know, a lot of times editors will come to us and, or, you know, NGOs will come to us and we work with them on projects. But for this grant that was from the International Women's Media Foundation, I had to pitch to editors, which, you know, happens a lot. But I found that in a lot of cases, people would say, oh, well, we just ran something about you know, another issue. This we ran in something about the global gag rule in another country in Africa recently, so we'll pass on this. And that happened a lot, where they had something that was what they said, quote unquote, similar, so they didn't want to do something. And I thought, well, this is something that is also part of the issue, because like they're not giving the readers enough credit for seeing the differences in these, and also to see that the impact of a larger, well, yes, it's not just one country in Africa, it's most of the countries in Africa that are being affected by this. You know, so there should be more coverage about it, but it's almost like they say, they think like it's not going to be that interesting to the reader because they did something different, you know, something that they think is similar recently. And with photos, I mean, it is sometimes easier because like you have different photos and stories, but so like the text is, you know, about the photos a lot. But for, you know, for the Mother Jones article, I did an article online for them. So it was an article and photos as well. But it's just I don't think it's any easier to just do photos, but I think like you can show the editor that they are visually impactful, and then they would be more interested. So sometimes it is actually easier to just do photos, and sometimes it's not.
Well, we should say then thanks to Mother Jones for printing this piece and running the piece.
Yes.
And then thanks to its Medium that has a section on its site. Is that right? Witness?
It's Witness. Witness is the magazine. Medium is their host.
Okay.
So, yeah, Witness is a World Press photo.
Okay. Sometimes I get confused when sometimes you see Medium on a lot of different sites. So thank you for clarifying that. So that's witness.worldpressphoto.org. And you can find Tara's work at yourcallradio.org. Tara Todros-Whitehill is a photojournalist and founder of Vignette Interactive. Jody Jacobson is president and editor-in-chief of Rewired.news. And on today's Media Roundtable, on this portion, we are talking about media coverage of abortion restrictions. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Ethiopian crash investigators call for an inquiry into Boeing. The New Zealand shooting prompts Australia to pass new laws targeting violent videos on social media. And why was a Chinese woman at Mar-a-Lago with four cell phones, an external hard drive, and a thumb drive? The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
1A is on at 11 a.m. this morning, right after Your Call. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@kalw.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and I'd like to thank Tara Todros-Whitehill for joining us. She is a photojournalist. You can find her incredible pieces that she reported from South Africa and Mozambique to see firsthand how the Trump administration's global gag rule is affecting women. And we are still joined by Jody Jacobson, president and editor-in-chief of Rewired.news, an online publication focused on health, rights, and justice. Jody, I wanted to ask you, given what's going on with the global gag rule, Tara had these incredible photos from South Africa, and in one of the pieces, she shows a photo of, it's like an underground clinic, and Mother Jones had another story in last March, actually, called Inside the Top Secret Abortion Underground. And I thought, oh, that must be about somewhere overseas. No, it's about somewhere in the South, in the rural South. So is it safe to say that the Republican Party, the anti-choice Republicans, and when we look at what's happening overseas, that's exactly what they want for women in the United States?
Absolutely. There's some changes in that we have better access, for example, to very early abortion care that women could, in fact, safely access on their own if it weren't otherwise being criminalized. So I think the difference is that in places where you have issues where lack of access includes lack of access to medication abortion, for example, and you have to resort to, and I don't say resort in a way that makes it dangerous, like let's say a vacuum aspiration abortion for an early abortion or other methods for a later abortion, and you don't have high standards of hygiene or trained people or what have you, or it's criminalized, people die because they will seek abortion care or they will self-induce in ways that are not safe when totally safe and when done correctly. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
The difference between having access to it and not having to go underground, but when you have to go underground, creates conditions for lack of safety, like the conditions that were found at, I'm spacing out his name now, but the guy in Philadelphia who was a horrible, actually illegal abortion provider, that was, you know, rightly sentenced and prosecuted. But the point is that abortion care is this among the safest kinds of care you can receive when done correctly. And there's the only reason to drive it underground is to shame women, to force them into pregnancies they do not want, and to make them criminals. And that is ultimately the point of all of this. I think there's a broader point. I think there's a broader point about demographic panic and, you know, and the sort of view of women literally as breeders and nothing more. But yes, I think that's the point of the far right in the United States, is to not care about whether and how women are able to exercise rights. Because let's face it, we have, among countries of similar economic levels, we have horrible maternal mortality rates, particularly so among black women.
Right.
So if you really cared about quote-unquote life, you might first address the issues that affect women in pregnancy and affect children in their health care, but those are things that are all being cut as well.
Right. And we can also say teen pregnancy rates are lower in countries that have actual birth control and sex education. But I want to ask you, Jody, because we have just a couple minutes left, about some other things happening in the United States. Just recently, John Bush, a Trump pick and a judge on the U.S. Sixth Court of Appeals, upheld Kentucky's quote, informed consent law. This requires abortion providers to perform an ultrasound, generally using a transvaginal probe for pregnancies of less than 9 weeks, on all patients seeking to terminate their pregnancies. The provider must then describe the fetus in detailed terms, pointing out its organs and play the sound of its heartbeat. Patients can only avoid this sound and description if they cover their ears and make noises to drown this out. So this was just upheld. Across the country, similar laws have been overturned. What is the significance of this ruling?
Well, I think the significance of this ruling, as I understand it, for one thing, there's a Trump-appointed judge involved here. But another thing is that, you know, we saw these bills, these transvaginal ultrasound bills, across the landscape several years ago, and particularly in Virginia, there was, you know, there were cases around this transvaginal ultrasound bill. The point of these bills is to humiliate women and to force or pregnant people to undergo painful and humiliating circumstances. Because a transvaginal ultrasound, having had one, is not pleasant. And also, particularly if you've got, you know, it also suggests that women are too stupid to know what they're doing, and that people who are pregnant are too stupid to know what's right for them. So I think the ultimate significance is that you've got a court that upheld this terrible process and medically unnecessary and literally coercive process, and now it's going to have to go through the system. And of course, we've got Brett Kavanaugh and other right-wing folks on the court, so who knows what will happen as these things work through the system.
And last week we had on a reporter from Slate who basically said you don't need the Supreme Court at this point because the administration is putting so many far-right extreme judges on lower courts. And so now we have all of these state laws that are going to go to the courts. I mean, what are your thoughts, just quickly, Jody, in our last minute? The six-week abortion ban, like the one in Georgia, is expected to be signed soon. And Elizabeth Nash with the Guttmacher Institute told CBS that the goal of the bill probably isn't Georgia anyway, it's Washington. So, I mean, what are your thoughts just on what we can expect in the coming months, given that we're seeing so many of these bills introduced and passed so quickly at the state levels?
Well, the difference is exactly what you said, the filling of the courts with right-wing ideologues who are barely, you know, capable of teaching a law school class effectively, never mind adjudicating the law in a fair and accurate way. So I think that the obvious intent is to throw as many of these things at the system as possible in order to create national bans and to undermine like the Voting Rights Act, was undermined by being gutted, undermine any real right to abortion care. That's what I think the point is.
Well, we're going to have to do a longer show about this, and we would love to have you back, Jody. Jody Jacobson is president and editor-in-chief of Rewire.news, an online publication focused on health, rights, and justice. In February, she wrote a commentary, "Reporters Must Do Better on Abortion." She says media coverage of abortion care in the United States is, to be blunt, abysmal. Jody, as always, thank you for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you so much. Last Friday, we had on Mark Joseph Stern. He's a legal writer for Slate. And I hope if you missed that show, please listen to it, because there's so much important information in there about the Trump administration's very far-right judges. He's appointing far more judges than his predecessors. And you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Now we are going to switch gears and learn about a lawsuit against Veritas, the biggest landlord in San Francisco. And today's guest, Noah Arroyo, assistant editor at San Francisco Public Press, writes that Veritas was founded in 2007. It says it owns more than 230 apartment buildings in more than 5,000 units, all subject to rent control because they were built at least 40 years ago, with many around 100 years ago. Noah Arroyo is assistant editor at San Francisco Public Press, and he writes excellent pieces about housing, homelessness, government, politics, business, and crime. Hi, Noah. Thank you for coming in.
It's always a pleasure to sit down with you, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you for this important story. Before we dive in and talk about Veritas. Mm-hmm. Affordable housing is a crisis around the country. Mm-hmm. But can you talk about just what we're facing in San Francisco? I mean, the prices mm-hmm. just continue to go up and shock people.
Ooh, yeah. I don't know what the latest numbers are, but I want to say that a one-bedroom apartment was recently pegged to go at somewhere north of $2,000. I know that when I was living in San Francisco before I got priced out, and now I live over in Fruitvale, so
oh,
I commute.
You got priced out.
I did, like wow. so many other people. I'm not special. But I was renting a one-bedroom apartment for about $1,400 a month, and that's just unheard of now. I wish I'd stayed. I wish I'd found a way to stay. Yeah, San Francisco is facing the brunt of the affordable housing crisis, or the affordability crisis that the whole state is experiencing. Obviously, you could pick any stat that you want, but black and brown people tend to have a worse off situation because they tend to be in the lower socioeconomic rungs. And so they get pushed out to the exteriors of the Bay Area or in other parts of the state, out of the urban centers.
And if it weren't for rent control, far more people would be pushed out. I mean, even mm-hmm. people with rent control, as you reported, are being pushed out. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Right.
But can you just talk about how rent control works in San Francisco and why it is so important?
Totally.
For working class renters, especially.
Right. Rent control comes with, as a policy, it will differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But there are certain state level controls that delimit what it can do in a certain jurisdiction. In San Francisco, the hallmarks of rent control are, for example, eviction protections. But what was most relevant to this story, and what I think most people know rent control for, is annual limits on rent increases. So, for instance, I think the most recent rent increase limit was 2.1%, but I could be wrong. It was somewhere around 2%, which meant that your rent couldn't increase more than 2% over the previous year. Bunch of caveats to that. One of the major facets of rent control that you got to understand if you want to understand the arguments against Veritas and what they are themselves denying, to backtrack a little bit, a key component of rent control is that when someone initially moves in, the price can be anything. I mean, you could move into a rent control unit at $3,000 a month, but year after year after that, the annual limit on rent increases keeps your rent from rising too much. So this creates a natural market incentive. Let's take, you know, humanity out of the equation for a second. It just creates a natural market incentive for a landlord to prefer newcomers to longtime renters, such as people who've been there for decades.
Right.
Their price will be very low. And we actually found that in the Superior Court records about this lawsuit, which contains 106 plaintiffs against this landlord, we found rent levels described for almost all of the plaintiffs. And we created a scatter plot that's available on my article, which you can find. You go to @SFPublicPress on Twitter or sfpublicpress.org. The scatter plot shows exactly this concept that we're describing.
Scatter plot?
A scatter plot.
What is that?
It's like a XY axis graph, but where each renter is a different point on that graph. And so you can see the overall trend.
Okay.
Where time is X. So basically, farther back they started renting, the lower they're paying, the more recent, the higher.
Right.
And you can see the trend from $247 per month for the lowest paying renter who moved in the 1970s.
Wow.
To somewhere north of $3,000 per month for the most recent renter.
Mm-hmm. And people will say $247, wow, that's so low for San Francisco.
Right.
We're talking usually, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you moved in back then, you're probably an older renter who's now living on Social Security in many cases, right?
Well, this person, if the court records are accurate, then this person, if I recall, moved in 1976 or somewhere in the 1970s.
Okay.
I've spoken to other renters who are plaintiffs to this lawsuit. And yeah, that is a narrative that holds true. The older renters do tend to be on fixed incomes because they moved in a long time ago.
Right. Okay, so before we get into the details, let's just talk about Veritas. As you report, this company was founded in 2007. It says it owns more than 230 apartment buildings with more than 5,000 units, all subject to rent control because they were built at least 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What else can you tell us about Veritas? Who owns this firm?
The owner and CEO is a gentleman by the name of Yat-Pang Au.
Mm-hmm.
He purchased a slew of buildings that became, I think, the bulk or at least a very large portion of Veritas back in 2011 from what was previously the king of rent control in San Francisco. This was the infamous Lemby family. They had accumulated somewhere, hundreds of rent control buildings. Although, as we can talk about if you want to, locking down the exact number of buildings that anybody owns in San Francisco is a difficult chore. Veritas owns at least 200. They told us more than 230 buildings. It is possible that they own more. We are not entirely sure.
And this is the biggest landlord in San Francisco because, as you report, you said...
Perhaps the biggest.
The CEO said he plans to expand the $3 billion Veritas empire around the region with Oakland as his next stop. So
this is
massive.
Yes. Yeah. He has said that he wants to expand. We were not able to get comment from Yat-Pang Au directly. So, and in all fairness, we did not ask him where he would expand his empire next, or even if he wanted to at this point. But yes, it is massive, and he has been looking towards Oakland.
Okay, so a lot of the buildings the buildings he owns are old.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, some of them are over 100 years old.
And because they are rent controlled.
Because they're rent controlled, right. And on the company's website, they say that they buy and improve aging buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens once they buy these buildings? What do they do?
Well, we have to draw a line here between two different ways to interact with this, right? One is through data. As you know, at Public Press and just me, I'm a nerd for spreadsheets, so I live in them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take a data approach to answering that question, your chore is much bigger and harder than if you rely on anecdote. Were I to rely on anecdote, then I would tell you that what I hear is they have a practice of acquiring buildings and then throwing money into them. Now, if you ask the tenants, the money goes into recently vacated units as well as common spaces, as well as, say, exterior paint jobs, so that those buildings become hotter items and can attract newcomer tenants who they already were going to pay more, but now they'd be willing to pay an even higher price because they're moving into a nicer place. If you were to ask Veritas would tell a different story. They would say that when they acquire a building, the first thing they do is they start looking for, okay, well, how can we improve this aging structure, which is a laudable goal. And these are aging structures. They're falling apart. Some of them were built in 1920, 1901. So the reason why I drew a distinction between relying on anecdote, whether Veritas's or the tenants, and looking at the data is because if you try to take a data approach, it is very difficult to vet either of those claims thoroughly, which is something that I'm welcome, you know, to talk about if you want.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, let's talk about that. But okay. I also want to – so tell us – about the plaintiffs living in Veritas buildings, and what are their main claims?
Their general claim is that, as I've said, that Veritas wants new tenants more than pre-existing tenants. And so they are pursuing that goal by a number of tactics that that culminate in an overall strategy that they want to have perennial construction on site at these buildings in order to apply the stressors of noise and debris to nearby neighbors, that they want to neglect or that they do neglect construction needs in the pre-existing tenants' units, any sort of, the artifacts of blight, things like pet infestations, peeling paint, crumbling walls, cracks in the floor, things like that. So through these stressors, as well as the lawsuit also includes allegations of a confusing automatic rental payment system that that causes tenants to accidentally fall into arrears, that overall what this culminates in is a systematic strategy to push out low-income and long-term tenants, which tend to be synonymous, not always, right, for the newcomer tenants.
And what are you hearing from these long-term tenants? Because we've done so many shows over the years about rent control and efforts to push people out. And what's often missing from the conversations is just the stress and the trauma that goes along with this. I mean, I have a dear friend, bless her heart, Marilyn Fowler, who was kicked out of her rent control home. And she had no choice but to move down to L.A. with her sons.
Yeah,
and she ended up
her.
Having a stroke. Because of all of the stress.
Yeah.
I mean, this was an activist in San Francisco that we lost.
Mm-hmm.
She's on Social Security and couldn't move anywhere else other than in with her sons.
Right. And I think that's where a lot of these tenants, at least the ones I spoke to probably about a little more than a dozen for this story. I've since spoken to at least a dozen more. I think that that's a common, at least, anxiety that they have, is that at the very least, if they choose to leave these rent control units, because in most cases what we're talking about, they're alleging an overall system of producing fear, producing anxiety that pushes them out. They choose to go. So if they choose to go, they're basically having to leave the city. Mm. Now, if they're on a fixed income, if they get injured, if they don't have health insurance, then they have to figure out transportation. They have to figure out where they're going to live. And as I can attest to, if you're commuting from out of town into your job in San Francisco, it is one more logistical barrier to having an easy life.
Right.
So that's probably the common element among the people I spoke to. And you have your extreme cases. And also you have your tenants who say, you know, I've never had a bad experience with Veritas. They just don't have occasion to interact with them, or they've gotten their complaints dealt with expeditiously. So there is a wide range of experiences.
And you write about the lawyers who are representing these tenants.
Yeah.
What protections are in place at this point? In San Francisco, we passed a law that ensures tenants will be represented by a lawyer. For a lot of people in the past, it was hard because the nonprofits are doing amazing work, but they were overloaded.
Mm.
And so in order to hire a lawyer, it can cost up to $200 to $300 an hour. So
right.
What protections are in place for these tenants?
Well, they experience the same sort of protections that just general rent control tenants experience across the city. I don't think that they have any more or less. I think more so the problem that they're grappling with is that what they're alleging is that Veritas's strategy is, I would say, an undercurrent. It's soft. It's indirect. And though a tenant may have eviction protections, that what Veritas is doing is not technically, or really, it's not an eviction, that it's tantamount to an eviction, but there is no protection against, perennial nuisances driven by construction when the noise level is below a certain decibel range, right? So then eventually you just leave because you don't want to deal with that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no protection against that. I think that, or at least not in the same way that there is a protection against an official eviction proceeding that occurs in a certain way, has to hit certain steps. I think that that's one of the reasons why these tenants would say, and the attorneys representing them banded together and are trying to combine forces and push back on Veritas. They say because it's not an overt eviction that's going on. It's something much more below the radar, mm-hmm. which, again, Veritas denies outright.
And since you do dive into the data, do we know at this point in San Francisco what percentage of rent-controlled apartments are owned by corporations like Veritas versus mom-and-pop landlords?
That is such a great question. I do not know. There's a reason why we called this, if I'm going to read it upside down on your... Searching for Truth and Tenants Lawsuit Against SF Corporate Landlord. Which, again, anyone can look up on sfpublicpress.org. There's a reason why we emphasize the searching part. Public record, there are limits to public records and what you can find there. Some of those limits are that the city does not record certain things. Some of those limits are that the city records those things, but in a manner that stymies what I would call systematic trend level research. For example, what entity owns... say 270 Turk, which is one of these buildings. I think it's called 270 Turk LLC. Well, that's Veritas, but no, it's 270 Turk LLC. Mm-hmm. And that's all of these buildings. Well, almost all of them are named, the owners are named after the addresses themselves. And this is not uncommon in real estate practices. So I went to the assessor recorder's office and I looked at ownership history, and very seldom did I encounter Veritas's stamp on any of these. So what proportion of rent control buildings or even all buildings citywide are owned by the specific entity, like if we're saying the true owner as opposed to the shell company, if I can say that term, that is not easy to know and perhaps not knowable in some cases. If they don't want to be known, they can hide in layers and layers and layers of companies and paperwork.
So that brings up another point. We have just about a minute or a minute and a half left. This one piece you wrote about Veritas is about 8 pages when I printed out, which is great because you're able at SF Public Press to really dive into these issues and find this data and really go over it. And that's the kind of reporting that we need to learn more about this. What are your thoughts overall about this particular issue when we're talking about rent, corporate landlords, and that kind of thing, given that it is such a crisis in the Bay Area and really across the country?
I think that, and I'm not pushing any legislation here, but I think that if you don't measure something, then you can't know how big it is. And we don't measure a lot of aspects of this problem. Mm. We're not the only ones who don't. We are the only ones who don't. Well, there are certain things that we don't measure that other jurisdictions do. But at the end of the day, what I think you would need if you really wanted to know the extent of this problem, which is multi-layered, is you'd probably need some sort of a registry. There's talk about doing that at the state level now. I want to say it's Assembly Bill 724 by Assembly Member Buffy Wicks.
Okay.
Buffy Wicks. That's an example. San Jose also has a rent registry. So if you go in that direction, maybe you start to measure the contours of this so that you can legislate against it.
Noah Arroyo is assistant editor at San Francisco Public Press, an independent publication. They're online. They also put out a great newspaper. I hope you can check them out. You can find his reporting on Veritas at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for coming in, Noah.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks
to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, Leah Cesarin, our intern, and Jean-Marie Asatoro, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.